this is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri in for Bob Kinzel. An entire country is being drawn into a national election that will choose the next head of state. Rousing debates have been held. One of the candidates hopes to carry on the family legacy of his father, who once led the country. And citizens are lamenting the lengthy process involved in this election to choose a new national assembly and leader. But we're not talking about the U.S. The country is Canada, where citizens will vote for a new parliament on October 19th. Election Day in Canada will end a grueling 78-day campaign, one of the longest in the country's history. And the candidate hoping to carry on the family name is not a Bush, but Justin Trudeau. He's the leader of the Liberal Party, and his father, Pierre Trudeau, was prime minister in the 60s and 70s. So today on Vermont Edition, we'll learn about how Canada chooses members of parliament and a prime minister. And we'll hear about the candidates and the issues that have been on everyone's mind north of the border. Here to guide us through the process and the issues is Jeff Ayres, professor of Canadian politics and dean of St. Michael's College in Colchester. Jeff, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
All right, we're going to start with exactly who Canadians will be voting for when they go to the polls in a couple of weeks.
Well, they don't, you know, the Canadians don't vote for Stephen Harper, only who's the current prime minister or the leader of the Conservative Party. They vote for a member of their riding, or what we would call districts in the U.S. Harper actually comes from one riding in the Calgary area. So they have this election, which takes place on Monday, the October 19th. There are five parties that are likely to get seats in the House of Commons. I'm not sure about the bloc, but in many ridings across the country, there'll be a wide variety of people that the Canadian voters can choose from to send an MP to the House of Commons, to elect somebody to the House of Commons. Whatever party wins the majority of the seats there, that leader would become the prime minister.
Those parties are the Conservatives, the Liberals, the New Democrats, or the NDP, as you mentioned, the Bloc or Bloc Québécois, and the Green Party. So we've been talking about this 78-day campaign, and we heard from Gail, who wrote, "What? That leaves no time to find and rake muck." She's flabbergasted. But let's explain why their campaign is only 78 days compared to ours that go on endlessly.
Well, there's a lot of different reasons for that. And again, you pointed out something accurate, that this is actually longer than most campaigns. But, you know, the Canadian system's much different in so many different ways from the United States. And one is that, you know, the prime minister, again, Stephen Harper at this time, but any previous prime minister, you know, had the option of asking for the dissolution of parliament. And that's, even though this is the first time, there was a fixed election date for this October 19th, the third Monday within 4 years after the previous election. But he still called an election. He asked the governor general. We can talk about this a little bit. Mm-hmm. The governor general represents the head of state, who's actually the queen, Queen Elizabeth II. He asked the governor general to dissolve parliament, to call for this election. But there isn't a tradition of a very long election season in Canada. It's usually 6 weeks to 2 months. That's the tradition. It's much, much shorter than in the United States.
Incredible. The Canadian election is Monday, October 19th. We're getting a primer today from St. Mike's Professor Jeff Ayres, who teaches Canadian politics. Listeners in Canada, what are your top concerns and issues in this election? And what do you want your American neighbors to know about how your system works? And Vermonters, how does this system sound to you? We want your calls from both sides of the border. Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your comments on Vermont Edition's Facebook page. There are several parties vying. We've mentioned three of the most likely to get representatives are the Conservatives, the Liberals, and the NDP. If the makeup of parliament is split three ways, and the election is kind of going that way, how is that prime minister going to be chosen?
Well, so it's one of the what everyone's paying attention to right now is, for most of this election campaign so far, it's been a really tight three-way race with very little room between the three parties. Something has happened in the last week. There does look like the NDP is losing support modestly, and it's becoming a two-way race. Looks this way. Things could still change between the two parties that have traditionally competed, the Liberals and the Conservatives. If It's interesting. This is the first – this is a new election and there's different things going on. The number of seats in the House of Commons expanded by 30 since the last election. There were 308 in the 2011 election. So in this 41st parliament, this will be the 42nd parliament. There are 338 seats.
And explain why that expanded.
Oh, it expanded primarily based on population growth. But there was some controversy. There were no additional seats or ridings given to Quebec, which actually isn't where there's been as much population growth. The seats primarily went out west, although Ontario did gain seats as well. But what that has done is it makes you – the party needs more seats to form a majority. In Canada, you have to get a majority of the seats. The prime minister is literally the – first among equals. He's one person who's elected from a party. He leads that party. But if that party gets a majority, this time it'll be 170 seats that you need to form a majority. Then they can govern. Right now, it's hard for me to imagine, although things can still change, that any party is going to get a majority. What is more likely is a minority government.
So any of these party leaders, they actually have to run in their own riding or district and get elected to parliament. If their party gets, in this case, 170 or more representatives in parliament in this election on the 19th, their party leader becomes prime minister. Otherwise, then there's some wrangling going on. So explain, as Craig writes, he's waiting for the day after the election when the governor general has to ask someone to form a new government. So explain what happens there. This is the interesting part to Americans, I think.
So if the polls today, if it looks like right now the Conservatives are up by a couple percentage points over the Liberals, Harper and the Conservatives would win a plurality of the seats. They would win the most seats, but not a majority. And the governor general would turn to Harper and see if Harper can govern. The way the Canadian system works, you have to command a majority support in the House of Commons. It's called you have to have the Convention of Responsible Government functioning. So when as we moved forward over the next month or so, and there was the Harper government began to attempt to govern, literally there'd be what's called a speech from the throne that's delivered by the governor general. It's quite likely that that speech from the throne, that legislative agenda would be rejected by the two main opposition parties, which then in the news in the last couple of weeks, the governor general said he's unlikely to want to turn and move for a new election. He may turn to the Liberals and the NDP and ask them to govern together to try to form some type of pretty unprecedented coalition government possibly.
So politically, do they match up in any way, the NDP and the Liberals, where they could form a coalition government?
They don't want to. I mean, they've been historically Canada for much of its history was a two-party system, then a kind of two-and-a-half party from – you mentioned Trudeau, Pierre Trudeau from the early 60s through – into the early 90s, it was the Liberals and the Conservatives with the NDP kind of the pivot party, a smaller number of votes. The party system blew apart in the 1990s. We could talk about that a little bit. Probably one of the most significant achievements for Harper actually is the way he rebuilt the Conservative Party, put the Reform Party and the Conservatives back together again. So the history of the Liberals though and the NDP is that they're both fighting for that left of center vote. And while it's exasperating probably for, I would think, a majority of Canadians who vote for one of those two parties to watch them divided in this way, I don't see them cooperating anytime, at least not in the near term. It'll be an unknown. It'll be very interesting to see what happens if with both of these parties with sizable seats, the Liberals and the NDP, how they might work together.
And then no majority, no coalition, vote again?
No, that's what I don't think there will be a vote again. I don't know what's going to happen. I actually think the Liberals and the NDP will be faced with an opportunity to cooperate to try to maintain a majority of support from a majority of the MPs in the House of Commons.
We're talking about the upcoming elections in Canada, and we have a call from Alan, who's calling from Montreal. Alan, thanks so much for joining us today. What's your question or comment?
Well, I have a couple of comments. The first is that the biggest difference, I think, between our systems of government is that in Canada, every day that our parliament is in session, there's a question period where the opposition gets to stand up and ask questions of the government, which are supposed to be answered. So rather than leave the questioning or the muck breaking up to the media, okay, the government is directly responsible to Parliament and supposed to answer these questions every day.
Gotcha.
The second big difference is that we weren't set up with our system wasn't set up with the same checks and balances, mm-hmm. which came from a distrust of government.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's designed to be more or less more cooperative, mm-hmm. and so we don't often run into the stalemate that we see in the States between Congress and the executive.
Excellent point.
And the third point I'd like to make is that the Democrats in the States that are like your left-wing party are so conservative, they probably couldn't be a part of our right-wing conservative party.
Okay, Alan, let me put these things to Professor Ayers. First of all, Alan did mention the opposition party, mm-hmm. which right now is the NDP for the first time. But explain exactly what an opposition party is in Parliament.
Actually, Alan, I loved Alan's points. I mean, every year, my colleague Dave Massell from the University of Vermont and I take our students up, and one of the highlights is question period. Unfortunately, this year, we're going up immediately after the election, so there won't be a question period. But he's right. It's something our students have never seen anything like it. It's very much the tradition of a Westminster parliamentary system. You have the government and the opposition, Her Majesty's loyal opposition is the official name of or the way one refers to the NDP, who is the official opposition. And it was their duty to hold the government to account. And the highlight is, especially if the prime minister is there, the prime minister gets up and responds to questions and then so forth as ministers. So, I mean, that's a big function for the opposition is to consistently try to hold the government to account on basic policies of the day, but also make the case that it's a government in waiting, that it's potentially available. You know, it's setting itself. It really, question period in part, it represents an ongoing election campaign.
Interesting.
I was just going to say a couple. Everything else Alan said, too, is that he's absolutely right. A huge hallmark of the Canadian system is, you know, far fewer checks and balances. It's built on. Traditionally, usually there is a majority in the House of Commons. The Canadian Parliament is actually comprised of the head of state, which is the Queen. Again, very unusually, the only time Americans probably grasp that is when they look at Canadian money. They have very hard time understanding. Canada has a system that separates the head of state and the head of government. We don't do that. Mm. Obama, as president, is head of state and head of government at the same time. I loved his last point, too, because it's one of the most fun things to talk to I teach Canadian politics right now and to talk to students about this, he's absolutely right. I mean, the Democratic Party in the United States would many of the members of the Democratic Party would be actually at home in the Conservative Party in Canada.
So is looking at the politics of the Canadian parties, I mean, are they a little bit more like Vermont political parties, which are more progressive, more to the left than the national parties here in the U.S.?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that's a good, you know, because certainly Vermont, a lot of my friends in Quebec would like to connect Vermont to Quebec, right? I mean, it's a very progressive state, a more liberal state than most states in the United States. But Alan's right again. I mean, the Green Party, the Bloc Québécois, the Liberals and the NDP, I mean, the bulk of the majority of those MPs would be arguably in the Progressive Caucus of the Democratic Party. You know, another way to look at it is the when you look at the last, I don't know, eight to 10 years of some of the main themes that the Republican Party has been concerned about in the United States, like take getting rid of Obamacare, for example. You've seen nobody in the conservative government get up and even hint at touching the third rail of Canadian politics, which is our national health care system.
Interesting. We're talking about the upcoming Canadian elections in the with the Prime Minister, the new Parliament, they'll be chosen. We want to hear your thoughts or questions about how Canada picks its leader. You can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri, and this is Vermont Edition. While Americans lament the presidential election that lasts a year and a half, Canadians are looking forward to voting on October 19th in the parliamentary election because that will end a 78-day campaign, the longest in Canada in more than a century. So today, we're looking at the major parties, their leaders, and the issues that have resonated with Canadian voters. Taking us through it is Jeff Ayres, professor of Canadian politics and dean of St. Michael's College in Colchester. And you can join the conversation by calling 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or by posting your questions or thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Let's talk to Daniel. He's calling from Burlington. Hi, Daniel. What's your question or comment?
Hello. I was a former student of Professor Ayres at St. Mike's, and I've always viewed Canadian politics as very interesting. My question is that what effect has the Canadian Senate expenses scandal had on the election so far?
Actually, I don't think it's had that significant an effect at all. I mean, if anything, one of the more interesting questions is how the whole topic of getting rid of the Senate has sort of disappeared. I mean, this was one of Harper's big themes for years when he was in the opposition, and then once he formed a government, one of its stated goals as somebody who sort of effectively represents Western interests and Western alienation was that they were going to get rid of this undemocratic so-called Senate. Again, it's a Senate in which the members are not elected. So I haven't seen as much controversy at all about the expense scandal. What we've begun to see, sort of things have almost been taken over by values and cultural issues, cultural concerns.
Can you give us a little bit about what that scandal was about?
Well, I mean, you know, it's interesting because having studied Canadian politics now for decades, there's an ongoing concern about the legitimacy, I guess you can say, of not as individuals, but of senators who aren't elected, who used to be that they could stay in for life. Now they're in till they're 75. Debates about the amount that they're paid. I can't even think, quite frankly, of the names of some of the senators, but I remember following. And to be honest with you, looking at from an American perspective, the monetary amount that was involved actually seemed quite small. Mm-hmm. But overcharging or inappropriately submitting expense accounts, right, that name. I've seen virtually very little anyway to say that that's affecting the election.
So let's look at the Canadian mindset when it comes to political thought right now. The current Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, has held the position since 2006. He's a conservative. Until he came to power, it had been controlled. Parliament had been controlled by the Liberals. So has there been a shift, that Harper represents in the Canadian mind thought?
It's one of the best questions you can ask. And Harper wants to argue that there has been, and it's not clear that's the case at all. I mean, it's very interesting to look at Harper as someone who's did a very successful job of knitting together a deeply divided party coming out of the 90s. I mean, the Conservative Party, which was the first, Sir John A. Macdonald, who was the first Prime Minister of Canada, was of the Conservative Party. In the 93 election, the party was destroyed. It went from 169-seat majority under the Prime Minister Mulroney to 2 seats. I mean, it wasn't clear that this party was going to be able to come back. So Harper formed his first government in 2006 as a minority government. It was an impressive feat to have, I think, pulled that party back together again. In the long term, right now, there's something I talk to my students about called a phrase called the pan-Canadian consensus. This idea that there's a widely shared set of common values that knit Canadians together that are still largely left of center values. I actually think that still exists, and we can just sit down and look at the election results from 2006, 2008, 2011, and maybe even this one if Harper gets the most votes, but not a majority. And we can see that he's going to win less than 40% of the popular vote almost every time, whereas there's a, you know, the other major parties are winning 60% or more of the popular vote, representing this more liberal set of values.
Mm-hmm. So tell us what Harper, you know, what the issues and positions he's running on this election that really kind of define him and his party.
You know, that's part of, I think, the challenge for Harper was that he did kind of run up against this timetable that was set up that where there was an election that was going to take place on October 19th. And also one of the if we could go back in time 2 years ago, if this was 2 years ago when the election were taking place right now, Harper would be running. You know, he would be celebrating arguably a very strong dollar and high oil prices, and he'd be touting the oil sands, if you will, or touting Canada's petro economy. So that certainly the economy is something he's had a difficult time, running on. I mean, Canada has been official right now is officially in a recession, two consecutive quarters of negative growth.
Mainly, you know, because of the drop in oil prices.
It's a huge piece of it. It's right. A huge, huge piece of it. What's really interesting is the new NDP premier out in Alberta, which we could have spent a whole hour just talking about how that transformation took place. She just, within the last day or two, has been making the case that here is this petro-rich province, and she's saying the Canada needs to prepare for a post-petro economy. So the economy is not – he's not running – he can't do as much. He can talk a little bit about not running as great a deficit as in previous years, arguably having a surplus more recently. Certainly security is a huge issue. I mentioned to you right before we came on that a year ago when the shooting took place of the soldier in Ottawa, Dave Massell and I were scheduled to take our students up that very day. We had to stop and we delayed it by 1 week. And since that time, you know, one of the controversial pieces of legislation is the Bill C-51 that has come through, which for supporters thinks it's going to help enhance security, enhance the sharing of information between intelligence and police services. But critics say it's going to dramatically undermine privacy. I think security in some ways is linked to this big, you know, huge issue that's come out right now over the it's kind of a culture war issue, the debate about the headscarves,
right,
and the facial coverings. Yes, exactly. That's become a really big issue right now, and it might actually be one of the reasons the NDP's losing some support.
Well, let's talk about the other parties. We spent a lot of time with the Conservatives, and the NDP has made great strides, as a matter of fact, in the last election, led by Jack Layton, mm-hmm. who has since passed away. Was it their message, or was it Jack Layton himself who kind of moved them into second place?
No, that's great. The last election was an election of firsts, many, many firsts, and that was certainly the first time the New Democratic Party had ever formed the official opposition. And it's credited to what they call the Orange Wave, the NDP's color orange, the Orange Wave across Quebec. I mean, it was an unexpected. Certainly, people expected the NDP to pick up seats, but no one, I don't think anyone, expected the kind of landslide victory in Quebec. A lot of it had to do with Jack Layton. I thought it was one of the most tragic moments in Canadian political history only a few months, really, I think, after that election, Layton came out and said he had cancer. And then, as you said, he passed away shortly after that. He was very well received, bilingual, that's an example where personality really mattered. And the NDP's values, interestingly enough, NDP being a more social democratic party, that value set overlapped well with the Parti Québécois and the Bloc Québécois, Parti Québécois provincially, Bloc federally. And so ideologically, it wasn't a huge shift for Quebecers to support the NDP, and they were drawn to Jack Layton.
Took a lot of seats away from the Bloc Québécois in 2011. Now, the leader of the NDP now is Thomas Mulcair. So how has he been accepted by Canadian voters?
Well, good question. I think he's been accepted well by people in Quebec, obviously. It's only more recently, it was only a few weeks ago that the NDP was going to there was going to be another orange wave, and he was at 50%. We've seen a significant decline percentage-wise in that province. You know, Canada's a a country in one in some ways similar to the United States. It is a really large country, and it's got regional political cultures. And so he's the there's pockets of the country that are naturally drawn to support the NDP. I mean, the NDP looks like it's going to do very well out in British Columbia. It's going to do well in Quebec still. It's still going to do well there. I think it certainly will still win the most seats in Quebec. And it will do well in certain urban areas. Ontario is the key battleground, and that's the area, maybe Quebec increasingly too, but Mulcaire can't afford to lose any more ground in Quebec, and he actually needs to gain more ground in Ontario.
I'm speaking with Jeff Ayres, professor of Canadian politics at St. Michael's College, and we're taking your calls. You can join the conversation at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also email us at vermontedition@vpr.net. Now, leading the Liberals, Jeff, is Justin Trudeau. He's young, he's charismatic, the son of Pierre Trudeau, who also served as prime minister. Early in the campaign, conservative television ads went after him with the line, "He's just not ready." And the conservatives and the NDP scheduled a lot of debates. They were kind of hoping that would show his lack of experience. So how has he fared so far? How has Justin Trudeau, mm-hmm. the head of the Liberals, done so far?
I would actually say he's done reasonably well. I mean, there's a different way to explain what's going on. One might be maybe we're seeing a natural repositioning of Canadian political support in that we're it's still early. We still have something dramatic could still happen in the next couple of weeks, but we're seeing the two traditional parties now sort of pulling ahead of the NDP for voter support. Certainly, you know, the Trudeau name has many people are drawn to it. Others are kind of turned off by it. It depends on what part of the country you're in. I think you're right. He is charismatic. He did very well in Monday's debate. We have a final French language debate tonight. Monday's debate was very interesting. We haven't talked about foreign policy, and we could squeeze in talking about Canada's place in the world. And he was seen as being very emotional, appealing to his father's legacy, both in terms of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, of official multiculturalism, and sort of writing Canada's place as a multilateral player in the world. And I you're right. Polls show right now that Canadians are actually quite favorably drawn to the policy platform, if you will, of the Liberals, but they aren't completely sold on whether this is just the Trudeau brand. How deep does one go within Justin Trudeau? Is he ready? I think that's still certainly a question.
We had an interesting question from Dennis, and this is again going back to just how things differ between the U.S. and Canada. It's about campaign financing, and he says, "Is Canada's approach not a better, more efficient, more democratic system? Tell us about campaign financing in Canada."
Well, certainly. I mean, there's so many things that we could talk about with how different a role money plays in the two political systems. Certainly, there are much more significant constraints on spending. I mean, since the Supreme Court decision, Citizens United's decision, I mean, we just have a virtual unlimited amount of money flowing into the American political system right now. Even reading in the last day or two, it's actually kind of hard to believe. You're looking at it and people are celebrating. Well, Bernie Sanders has raised more money right now than Obama did in 2008 or something. It's hard to kind of get my head around that.
Right.
So there, first of all, there just isn't the amount of money sloshing through the Canadian political system, and then there are much more significant constraints on the amount of money that can be spent by the party. It also certainly affects. It just simply affects the influence of money is tempered certainly by the shortness of the campaign season. I mean, that's huge. We are, as we all know, right? We are in the middle of a presidential season, and we're very far away from it.
Let's get to the last two major parties, the Greens and the Bloc Québécois. Very briefly, tell us, you know, where they stand politically and what they can hope to gain in this election.
Well, you know, it's interesting. The leader of the Bloc came back. Gilles Duceppe has come back to lead the Bloc Québécois. And, you know, a week or so ago, it looked like the Bloc would be completely shut out and not get any seats. The beneficiaries of the NDP losing some support in Quebec has been the Bloc and the Conservative Party. But, you know, I don't know. Certainly one of the themes we could we don't have a lot of time, but we could certainly say that the whole theme of separatism, secession, it's not playing that well. That's not a particularly attractive chord for most Quebecers. So, I think Doucette may – the Bloc may win a couple of seats, but I don't really see that party having much impact, except that it may siphon votes away from the NDP. The Green Party, you know, it's Elizabeth May leads the Green Party. She's out in British Columbia. The bigger question, if Canada had a different type of electoral system, they had a proportional representation style electoral system, the Green Party would have a significantly larger number of seats. So they're definitely hurt by the first past the post system.
Yep. The Canadian national election is Monday, October 19th. Tonight in Montreal, the leaders of the five major parties will hold another debate, as Jeff mentioned, in French. Jeff Ayers is a professor of Canadian politics. He's the dean of St. Michael's College in Colchester. And Jeff, I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
This has been a lot of fun and great questions.
Thanks. Coming up next, we'll hear from Secretary of State Jim Condos about a national report that raises a lot of concerns about the condition of voting machines around the country, including in Vermont. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri in for Bob Kinzel. The Brennan Center for Justice issued a report recently on the security and reliability of voting machines used across the country. The report says that 43 states are using machines that are nearly at the end of their expected lifetime, and that includes voting machines used in Vermont. So what is Vermont doing about it? Secretary of State Jim Condos oversees elections. VPR's Bob Kinzel talked with him about how Vermonters cast their ballots.
The Brennan Center report paints a pretty bleak picture about the condition of voting machines around the country. Tell us about what the situation is here in Vermont.
I will. First of all, I do want to say that the Brennan Center report raises a very important question, the need nationwide to modernize our elections equipment and infrastructure overall. I really don't want to minimize this topic because it is a serious issue, and nationwide it is really serious. We're fortunate here in Vermont in that our machines do not get the use that you will see in a lot of other places around the country. Let me use an example. The city of Burlington has about 17,000 ballots that were cast in the 2012 election. And the city of Boston had 255,000, about 15 times the number of the city of Burlington. That's equivalent of 15 years worth of elections that Boston had versus the Burlington numbers. So our numbers, and Burlington's our biggest city, and from there the numbers go down quickly. Our vote totals are much lower. And we do not see the problems that you see elsewhere. Secondly, we actually here in Vermont have a service contract with our supplier of these machines, and they service those machines whether they were used or not each and every year. And this helps to maintain them in good quality. We have not had any real problems with any of the machines. We don't anticipate any problems going forward.
And you do a pretty rigorous audit of the machines following every election, don't you?
We absolutely do. And it was something actually that came about when I was in the legislature. We added – at that time, we used to do four cities or towns, and we would actually audit two races in each of those towns. This past year, we tried a new system, and we were able to do six towns. We are able to do all the races that were involved, including local races in that town, and we were able to do it in half the time that it took us to do the other ones. And what we have found so far through our audits is that our vote tabulators are far more accurate than our hand counts.
Am I right to say that all towns in Vermont either have what's known as an optical scan machine? That's when a voter fills in a circle by a candidate's name and then the ballot is fed into a tabulating machine, or they use paper ballots that are still counted by hand.
That is correct. We have about 110 or 112 cities and towns that use the optical scan machines. They represent, and by July of next year, that number will be up to 130 towns. And we have that, those 130 towns will represent about 80% of the vote total.
Would you like to see more towns move to the optical scan machines?
The optical scan machine, it's really a town, it's a townwide issue, and it currently what it is there is a mandate by the state. The law was passed last year that any town over 1,000 registered voters must use a optical scan machine. As I have said earlier, they're more accurate, and we have found that the vote totals are actually produced much quicker, within minutes. So yes, it would make sense. However, there is a cost to these machines, and the cost right now is between $5,000 and $6,000 per. So, do you really want to use one, pay for one for a town that maybe only has 300 voters?
The Brennan Center report also discusses new technologies that can be used in the future. They talk about a touchscreen computer model as one of these new devices. What are your thoughts about that form of voting?
Well, fortunately, when I was served on the Government Operations Committee around 2002 or 3, I forget exactly when, I actually was the one that put the motion to the committee that we must have a paper ballot at the end. There are towns or states, I should say, across this country right now that use what they're called DREs, which are touchscreen votes. And those things can get out of – the monitors can get out of calibration, and you might think you're clicking on Bob Kinzel's name and you might be picking on John Dillon's name next to it because of the way that the monitor looks. So it is a problem, and we're not convinced – well, certainly we can't even use those types of machines in Vermont unless there's a paper ballot at the end of the day. And I'm not convinced that it's the best way to go.
If you do have a recount, then what you're really doing is going in and just checking the tabulation on the machine as opposed to looking at a ballot and sending it through the optical scan machine again.
That's exactly right. In fact, when we do the audits at the end of the year, at the end of the general election, what we do not use the same machine that was used at that election. We use a different machine totally to make sure that there was no problem. The other factors that the Brennan Center report raised were using Wi-Fi or using the broadband connection to a central location and whatever, and the chances of security hacks that could be breached. We do not have to worry about that here in Vermont because our machines are not connected to the internet in any way. These machines are freestanding. The chips are held in the vaults once they receive the chips at the town clerk's office, they're put into the vault and kept there. So it's a matter of, we have the chain of command on those chips. These machines actually operate on two software systems. One operates the machine, the other operates the scanner. So it's actually a dual operational system that makes it work better.
Some towns, some states are talking about internet voting. What do you think of that idea?
I think in the report you'll see that there was an MIT professor that does not think too highly of this idea, and I'm with him. We're not at the point. We can send a ballot out we send a lot of ballots to overseas and military voters by email, but they still have to mail the actual print the ballot, fill it out, and then send it back to us.
So it sounds like in general, despite what the Brennan Center said about many states, in the state of Vermont, you think we're in pretty good shape.
Our machines are stable, reliable, and accurate, and I have total confidence in the ones that we do have. I do think that we are already looking for the future. We know that the future is coming, and the technology is changing very, very fast at this point. I'm actually not sure we're going to be using freestanding tabulators, OptiScan tabulators in the future. We may not even have to print ballots in the future, because what will happen is it'll be a print on demand right at the polling place, and you'll be able to go into the office or into the polling location, and once you're registered, they'll print a ballot for you directly, and then you fill that ballot out and run it through whatever scanning technology we're using at that point. the technology is changing so fast, Bob, that in many cases some of this new technology is using off-the-shelf scanners, so we're not going to have the high cost that we have today. And Vermont is very fortunate. In 2002, there was a lot of HAVA money, Help America Vote Act money, that was sent out. We have been very frugal in the Secretary of State's office. We're one of the few states that actually has some of that money left over. And the reason we kept that money and have been frugal with it is to ensure that we had enough money to pay for the next generation machine, whatever that machine is.
So despite what new technologies might be implemented in Vermont, there still will always be a paper ballot.
Unless the legislature changes the legislation, yes. And my recommendation would always be that we have a paper ballot.
That's Vermont Secretary of State Jim Condos speaking with VPR's Bob Kinzel. You can read more about the Brennan Report on voting machines online. Go to vpr.net/Vermont Edition. And as you've no doubt noticed, the weather has finally turned colder. The fall foliage makes it a great time to get into the woods after work for a nice late evening walk. But what would happen if you got lost and had to spend the night? Marie DiBenedetto, a primitive skills instructor and youth mentor at Earthwalk Vermont in Plainfield, gives us a lesson on how to build an emergency debris shelter that will keep you warm and safe.
Typically, you wouldn't want to get yourself in a situation where you need to build a debris shelter, but you never know. And sometimes you're on a casual walk in the woods and it's getting dark and you're lost. And the best thing you can do to keep yourself safe is to build a debris shelter. And luckily, here in the Northeast, we have all the materials we need to stay warm and dry in that situation. The first thing you need to do is maintain your positive mental attitude. You want to keep in mind the 5 W's of shelter building: wind, water, wildlife, widowmaker, and weather. So this is a good shelter spot because we're above ground on the crest of a hill, and so I know that if we get a serious rainstorm, it's not going to come wash away my shelter, and I'm not going to wake up in a pool of water. Thinking about the natural wind direction of the place, I'm looking around for signs of wildlife. I definitely, if I see bear, coyote, scat, I don't want to sleep there. Looking up to make sure there are no widowmakers. I do not want a tree to fall on me while I'm trying to sleep. And the 5th W I'm looking for is water. I want to make sure that I'm near a water source if I would need water, but I don't want to be too close to the water source because it could be breeding mosquitoes. Animals will be attracted to that spot. So a ridge pole will be maybe a foot or a couple feet taller than your body size, and that is going to be what supports your whole shelter. You want your shelter to be pretty small, just a little bit larger than your body, because you want to utilize all of your body heat and trap it in. So you want to find a notch that is around your waist level, I would say would be appropriate for a ridge pole. The ribs are shorter sticks that you are going to lay diagonally on your ridge pole. You know, if you can picture human ribs, that's what you want on the sides of your shelter. So you'll start with small sticks that are just a few inches, and then they'll get taller as you move up towards the notch of the tree. After that, you're just going to want to start piling as many leaves and sticks as you can. From the tip of your middle finger to your armpit, that's about the thickness of leaves that you want. And you just pile leaves. You'll be tired of piling leaves, and you just keep piling some more. Because it takes a few hours, it will keep you preoccupied. And so there's the psychological aspect of it, of giving you something to do for a few hours, so you're not sitting there freaking out saying, oh my gosh, I'm lost. I'm never going to get out of here. It's just really cool to be able to go out into the woods, any woods in all of New England, and you have everything you need right there to stay warm and stay dry. It won't be as comfortable as your own bed, but you definitely won't get in a situation where you're suffering from hypothermia, and you can stay very warm in a debris shelter overnight.
That was Primitive Skills instructor Marie DiBenedetto, and Christopher Biddle produced our story. And that's it for today. Coming up Monday, we're talking about the issue of sexual assault on college campuses. We'll look at the latest statistics from Vermont schools and learn how they're taking on the problem. Send your questions or comments to Vermont Edition at vpr.net and listen Monday at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels and Sam Gale Rosen, with production assistance from Hannah Kearns. Liam Connors directed the program. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. And I'm Rick Singeri. Have a great weekend.